Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Excited because we're devoting this week to the recent NVCA award recipients. And with us, we have one of them, David Rothside, who's a principal with Shield Capital. David, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Christian. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. I know I just mentioned, but I have to start with a congratulations for being recognized by the NVCA. That's awesome.
Yeah, always fun to receive an award, no matter how old you get. So it's cool.
Good. Well, hey, we'd love to use this time to better understand your role at Shield Capital as well as the firm. So why don't we just start with investment thesis? What's
amazing?
Where does Shield focus?
Yeah, so Shield Capital is focused on that intersection of national security and commercial capability. The firm got started in September of 2021 with the first close of our first fund. And we strongly believe that entrepreneurs that can operate, you know, within those two worlds are really going to outpace their peers, and that you can do good and well simultaneously. And then within that kind of broad technology area, a lot of times colloquially known as dual use technology, we focus on four technology verticals. So artificial intelligence, autonomy, cybersecurity, and space. And we have a high preference to lead rounds and early rounds. So whether that's pre-seed, seed, series A, really get in there, roll up our sleeves, and help the entrepreneurs build those companies from the ground up.
Fantastic. And what's your role inside of Shield?
So at Shield Capital, you know, I think like any VC, we're all wearing lots of different hats. But yes, day in and day out, you know, a lot of deal flow, due diligence, and then spending a fair amount of time helping our portfolio companies operate, specifically as they think about their go-to-market strategy with the Department of Defense and broader federal agencies. And a lot of that is sort of predicated on my background, which I think we can get into later, but, you know, understanding how the national security buys capability, that is what I am spending a fair amount of time with all of our portfolio companies that have a product relevant to the national security apparatus.
All right. You know, and this is I think it would be really helpful, actually, if we can take a moment, take a step back, and if you can share with us what your career progression has been leading up to Shield.
Awesome. Sure. So, well, you know, love to give a shout out to where I'm from. So from Cincinnati, Ohio, and then went to college at Miami University in Ohio, go Red Hawks, class of 2008. While at Miami, sort of stumbled into the ROTC program. You know, for listeners, I was a sophomore in high school when 9/11 happened. No real military in my family. Cincinnati, while close to a big Air Force base called Wright-Patterson, not really a lot of military kind of in and around that area, so not a lot of exposure. So yes, really stumbled into the ROTC program and joined, signed on the dotted line, then told my parents, and I was an economics major. In the Air Force, you can do a lot of different things. Obviously, people know you can be a fighter pilot, or you can be an intelligence officer, among any host of other jobs. For me, the career path that I chose was in the acquisition workforce. And I think that's just a fancy way of saying a businessman in uniform. You're the individual sort of cutting contracts to the defense industry base to build compelling technology to deter adversaries from doing anything they shouldn't. And so that was sort of what I did for 13 years. Across a lot of different technology verticals, whether that be in space, with aircraft, data aerial networks, cybersecurity. But most notably, I was out at Defense Innovation Unit in 2016. And that was the Department of Defense's like first real move to try to build bridges between the kind of Silicon Valley innovation ecosystem and the national security apparatus. So being on the ground floor, and that's where a lot of the Shield Capital origin story comes from, is how can the DoD take advantage of venture-backed startups that are building the technology capability of the future? And I just, happen to be one of the people there helping build out that business model. And then fast forward to 2021. So now at that point, I've been in for 13 years, and I get a call from the managing partner at Shield Capital, Raj Shah, who was the director of Defense Innovation Unit back in the day. And he says, "Hey, I want to build this venture capital firm, take a lot of the lessons that we learned at Defense Innovation Unit and apply it in a venture capital model. And I want to be able to actually help our portfolio companies sort of access the defense marketplace," right? And so that was kind of the skill set that I brought to the table. And then over the last 4 years, I've been learning the rest of the tricks of the trade of venture capital. And I will just pause it real quick because, defense tech has become pretty hot over the last couple of years, especially, since the war in Ukraine and the conflict in Israel. We were sort of ahead of that time period, right? So this is fundamentally what we believe will yield a good investment result for our limited partners and, of course, the startups that we work with.
So really impressive, and thank you for your service. And I just a quick shout out. We were talking beforehand. I understand you're a reservist today.
Yep, still a reservist at the Pentagon. So I've been doing that since switching over to Shield Capital. It's fun and great to kind of put on the uniform for several weeks out of the year and, do staff work and help out where I can. Definitely that sense of mission and purpose is meaningful.
I absolutely imagine, but I can also imagine it makes good sense why Raj reached out to you. I mean, not only working together, but I imagine you have this bird's eye view of exactly what it's going to take to win government business. I have to ask, what were the parents' response when they found out you signed up?
Yeah, I remember we were at a family function out of town in Chicago, and I kind of just like broke the news to them in the back of a rental car. And I think my mom, in kind of typical Jewish mother fashion, was a bit hysterical, thinking, the next day I was getting shipped off to Iraq. And this is like 2005, 2006, and so wasn't so great over there at the time. My dad was more stoic about it, and very supportive. And they both come around. They came around very quickly when they saw how it kind of helped me mature as an individual, giving a lot of structure both in college and then, of course, out in the workforce.
Well, shout out to ROTC and Miami University. That's awesome.
Thank you.
I'm gonna say there's a perception that winning government contracts can be very arduous and tedious. I visualize, 12-inch thick RFPs. That I don't know if that was the case, is still the case, but what sense can you give us as to how the process has evolved over the years?
Sure. Yeah, I think, when I was growing up in the acquisition system at the beginning of my career prior to Defense Innovation Unit, the idea of working with venture-backed startups, not that it was anathema to the system, it just didn't exist, right? These were parallel universes operating within their own world. And so really, you think about how far we've come as a procurement system in at least understanding the value of a venture-backed startup and letting, private capital seed the significant majority of the R&D so that the Department of Defense can just buy the technology and know that there's a startup that is, going to just constantly be making improvements to the technology and benefiting from the economies of scale. Because, if you're venture-backed, you still need to sell into a large addressable market. I think we've come a long way from where we were when the late great Ash Carter set up Defense Innovation Unit Experimental back in 2015, but we still have a long way to go. And there's nothing like modern warfare to sort of showcase the material benefit that some of this new gray technology, whether they be UAV drones or access to, commercial SATCOM like Starlink, the effect that that can have on the battlefield and sort of showcase the importance of these systems that maybe once upon a time were thought to be toys, not military capability. And so I think we're seeing a change, and this latest administration has been putting a pretty massive emphasis on, buy commercial, go faster, leveraging a lot of the processes that we instantiated at Defense Innovation Unit back in 2016 to help sort of accelerate this adoption. But by no means are we even close, to where we need to be. So I think we're still sort of investing on the promise and potential of recognizing this generational change that is occurring within the acquisition workforce, not just across the Department of Defense, but federal government, our allies, right, and other partners.
And so, is there a catalyst we can point to mid last decade that kind of set this in motion?
I think maybe you could point to two. We'll go with three. We'll go with three. So I would say SpaceX has had a remarkable impact on the new space economy. When you lower the cost of access to space from something like $16,000 per kilogram to now roughly $3,000 per kilogram, and hopefully dropping, as Starship gets up and running and some of the other competitors, whether that's ULA's Vulcan or Blue Origin's rocket as well, New Glenn. These things will driving competition in the marketplace is huge, and space is just, a growing more important domain as a force multiplier for all things that we do terrestrially, and there's more applications yet to be leveraged again as the cost of doing business drops. I would say Palantir, showcasing the power of software and bringing, your data into places where you can query and apply artificial intelligence algorithms to better leverage the data that you already have in order to create effects, on the battlefield or for deterrence capabilities. So Palantir, they had to sue the Army famously about a decade ago to have access to compete on a contract that went to a traditional defense contractor, and they won the case and eventually won the contract, and they continue to sort of proliferate within the Defense Department. I think so much now that they're the most valuable, defense contractor out there on the public market. And then I think Anduril has really also sort of showcased this ability to invest in technology that your customer, and in this case, the customer being men and women in uniform, are really going to like, versus the traditional process, as you kind of alluded to, those, RFPs that are, textbooks thick. Instead of waiting for the requirement to come out and then building a budget around that and then a contracting strategy around that, right? That process that I just described can be like a 5-year thing. When you think about the size of the bureaucracy and how much coordination has to go, including Congress, Anduril taking an approach of let's just build the thing we know the military needs, and it's going to be so good, they're eventually going to come around, build a requirement around that. We can leverage some of these more innovative contracting vehicles and speed up the process. And so this has led to a revitalization. But it's still early days, right? It's not like SpaceX is on the public market and, a huge success, although privately it seems to be doing well. And the same thing goes for Anduril.
Many of the early stage companies we work with will win a SBIR, and
Yes.
it seems to be the common entry point into working with the DoD. But it's interesting. Is there a counterpart name for the work that you just described Anduril doing? Hey, we'll build it first because we think this is what you need.
So, Anduril, even on some of their early contracts, they were predicated off of some SBIR programs. And then they had sort of the ability and the wherewithal to turn those SBIR phase ones and phase twos. And happy to sort of explain the differences here to the audience into
Yes.
what's called a phase three SBIR, which means the department is awarding you a sort of a standalone contract. Budget is coming from specific agencies, not the SBIR pot of funding, which is essentially a tax on all R&D programs over a certain amount. They pay into the SBIR bucket, and then the SBIR program, which every federal agency has, they award these small dollar phase ones, which can be anywhere from as small as 50K to maybe 250K, and then these phase twos, which you might think of those as like prototyping, and that can be anywhere from like 500K to 1.5 million. You can only get a phase three, which allows a small business to get a sole source non-competitive award for the things that they did in phase one or phase two. And then the customer can just buy that capability, assuming they've got the budget and the mandate to have it. And so it was actually a phase three that Anduril got pretty early on for their Sentry Tower that allowed them to then get some real momentum in the defense space. So, what I would say about the SBIR program writ large is, if used correctly, they can be great stepping stones. But I think what we have seen is kind of an abuse of the SBIR program writ large, where companies just compete to win these grant dollars with never the intention to commercialize their technology and become non-SBIR companies, which essentially means you're no longer qualified as a small business. So either your headcount is over 500K, or your annual revenue is over a certain threshold, depending on what's called a NAICS code, which is a very nerdy thing, and not super important for the purposes of this conversation. But essentially, the SBIR program could be better. And in fact, if your audience would be so kind as to promote what Senator Ernst, the chair of the Small Business Committee for Entrepreneurship, has pushed out as her legislation for the reauthorization of the SBIR Act, it would actually help sort of get rid of some of these bad actors taking advantage of the SBIR program and allow it to go back to its original intent, which is seed capital for the next generation of entrepreneurs that want to build meaningful companies, not just for the DoD, but for the United States.
We'll include a link to Senator Ernst's legislation in the show notes. So, if anyone wants to quickly go take a look, it'll be there. One of the things that I've always, I thought the SBIR program was great for an early stage company because it gave them an opportunity to generate revenue, engage, learn. But I've also always thought that there's a dichotomy between, the creativity you normally see an entrepreneur and the needs of a corporation, in this case, government. It sounds like with the work that Anduril is doing is that maybe there is a shift taking place where there's a realization if we let entrepreneurs be entrepreneurs, we may see better outcomes. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's a fair assessment. I think, DIU and then a bunch of other organizations like AFWERX and SpaceWorks and a few others that are like, inside the Department of Defense, they have started to recognize the value of, entrepreneurs with audacious visions, able to raise capital from the private sector, build that technology in a way that benefits the national security environment, and they should just buy it. Right. And maybe you need to iterate on a little bit. And certainly, the commercial grade product versus the military grade product is going to have some differences. But, the essence and baseline of that technology ought to be very similar versus, this, I'm going to use this term, cottage industry, basically something that would not translate between the two. And software, I think, is a great example of that, right? And famously, I would say the DoD buys software after the fact. You sort of slap the software onto the hardware, and it's very clunky. It does not give a joyful experience, right? And as somebody who has served a long time, I will tell you, even the business systems that I had to use, and you would think like, oh, well, that should just go to like an SAP or a Salesforce, and like, oh no. These are software products built by companies that do not have a background in software, right? And they build exactly to the requirement. So unless you, the user, really articulated it exactly how you want it in the best way with all the feature sets and the colors and the bubbles, et cetera, like you're going to get exactly what you asked for and nothing more, nothing less.
We're recording this. So, real quick, I'd like to focus on what maybe some of the positive aspects of the military-industrial complex. So famously, cited by Eisenhower as he was wrapping up his tenure as president. Arguably, though, there are people who are critical of the relationship. And as we record this in the news last week, there was evidently a handful of executives at a handful of companies, Palantir, Meta, Google, who are becoming officers in the army, just given
Yes.
their roles. What's your perspective? What are some of the benefits for this marriage of U.S. tech corporations and the military?
Yeah, I'll give credit to Shyam Sankar, who is one of those people, right? He's the CTO of Palantir, and he was instrumental, along with my boss Raj Shah, in sort of helping establish this Joint Reserve Command Unit, Unit 201. And it is he used this term at a talk not too long ago. You know, we have this, and Eisenhower talked about the military industrial complex and to be concerned about it. And what I think we're all trying to push forward is that we have an American industrial complex. If you go back to World War II, you know, there's several anecdotes of, you know, commercial companies like Ford and General Motors, among others, they were building the technology and the manufacturing prowess that won us World War II, right? And the book Freedom's Forge like outlines all of this masterfully. And I think that's where we're trying to push, right? And where Shield Capital is really trying to accelerate is these technology companies built by entrepreneurs who don't understand anything about the military, right? And the Department of Defense. And we, as investors at Shield Capital, can say that actually has significant military application. I understand you didn't grow up in the system, and so it's all acronym soup to you. We can help you unlock that as a meaningful vertical on your way to becoming a billion-dollar company that is selling to, you know, regular Fortune 500 businesses as well as the DoD. And again, you know, the taxpayer, the national security apparatus, America's national economic security becomes better off in that vernacular. And so we've got a lot of awesome companies that are doing exactly that. And in certain cases, the DoD is a good first customer for them. In certain cases, we actually advise our startups not to work with the DoD. Even you don't even bother doing a cyber. The DoD is not organizationally structured to leverage your technology in a way that makes sense for your business goals and outcomes. And you should go right where you're progressing faster, where you're able to build momentum. And in a lot of cases, that is the commercial sector. So we're trying to be very mindful about how we advise the startups that we're investing in to access and leverage it.
So that comes back to dual use. And so I'm curious, do you, so a couple, this is year four now, seeing patterns amongst founders that seem to succeed with this mindset of I need to create a solution that not only I can use potentially within the government, but also commercialize it in the private sector?
Yeah, I think this is maybe something that has really been super apparent to me and to us at Shield Capital, right? Especially those of us that were at Defense Innovation Unit in those early days. When we were out there in Silicon Valley, right, and the headquarters of DIU is in Mountain View, we had to sort of convince the VCs there in the Valley that the DoD can be a good customer for your startups and that the technology they're building is super relevant to us. But we had to do the convincing, right? Because to them, it's, you know, time is the most valuable resource. And if this isn't going to result in a contract, a quick yes or a quick no, I'm better off, you know, focusing on other sectors. And I would say that today, when we engage with entrepreneurs, the mindset has totally shifted. I think a lot of that has to do with Ukraine, but also the just geopolitical issues facing the world today, where all of a sudden, partners that were great market opportunities for entrepreneurs have now been very much closed off, and in certain cases, a recognition that you're being undermined if you do business there. And so I think the idea that the DoD, it is an $800+ billion market opportunity. Now, granted, a lot of that goes to paying for salaries and healthcare and facilities, but still a very large market opportunity. And again, I think entrepreneurs like the idea of being a part of the national security storyline, and it's become more and more prevalent to them, especially in the wake of something like Ukraine.
I have one other thought I can add to the list, but I want to get your take. And that is, where we sit today is that given higher interest rates, there's a bigger emphasis on profitability. You and I both know that a key to that is a paying customer. Do you feel like that's contributing to the mindset as well? Is that, hey, if I can bring something to the market that I know someone's going to pay for, I may pursue it.
Yeah, I would say that, doing work with the DoD is one, they have to have a need for what you're building. So not and sometimes to convince them that what you're building will help them, get rid of other legacy things, that can be it's not so dissimilar from another selling to another Fortune 50 type company. It's bureaucratic, it's tough, it is a long sales cycle. But I think, as you alluded to it, if you get that customer, it's a sticky customer. There are significant switching costs to trading out one software platform for another, or one capability for another. And, the DoD always pays its bills.
Right.
So, on the commercial side, I've seen plenty of contracts where the customer got a little bit flaky, right? And the pipeline was a bit inflated. And so it is a more sure dollar, but it can take a long time to actually go from selling, tens of units to thousands of units. So there is that procurement process, that plenty of people have spoken eloquently about. But just to sort of summarize it, ultimately Congress issues the budget. That budgeting process in a normal year, and this year, fiscal year 25, is anything but a normal year. But that process can take 18 to 24 months to sort of ramp up. So you might have a great prototype that won an SBIR or a different other R&D contract, and it might be really, really great. But in order for the department to mindfully and directly scale it, could be a 2-year process. But I would say that's where the venture capital funding then also comes in handy, right? Is to sort of help bridge that gap, continue to iterate on the product. So by the time you're ready for those like long tail procurement dollars to scale the technology, it's even better than the user had it before.
Makes great sense. And so with that, I'd encourage our listeners to go out to Shield's website to look at the portfolio and what some of these companies are that straddle the fence. But any one or two investments top of mind you can share with us now that may be a really good example of founders who are looking to commercialize while at the same time working with the government.
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to highlight one of our early investments in Fund One. The company is called Albedo, and it is a space technology. And they're putting up a satellite in what's called very low Earth orbit. So, for the unfamiliar, you've got traditionally low Earth. If this is the Earth, you got low Earth orbit, maybe 350 to 1,000 kilometers above altitude. And you've got middle Earth orbit. And then you got geosynchronous orbit all the way out at like 30,000 kilometers, right? And what Albedo is doing is actually going lower than low Earth orbit to very low Earth orbit, right? A very fancy term, essentially under 300 kilometers. Very challenging to operate. But if you think about logarithmic scales, the closer you get to Earth, the more exquisite your imagery can be. And so they have a satellite that launched in March, and is now, by the time this podcast comes out, will be able to take pictures at 10 centimeter resolution. So if you think about the strike that just happened in Iran, and if you are interested in getting pictures of what that looked like, you would be able to actually task the satellite for your own purposes and check out to a very, very fine detail, better than anything else on the commercial market today. And again, we believe that that will have some very significant commercial applications when you can get down to that resolution, while also simultaneously being able to do thermal imaging at a 2 meter resolution. So not only being able to see spatially like what's going on, but whether or not from an emission standpoint, things are heating up or cooling down. And we're just really excited for them. And the team's worked exceptionally hard to get to where they are to build some really, really awesome technology.
Yeah, I'm just listening to that. I can imagine any number of different industries that would value that data to get a sense of the place on the ground. Dave, it's been an awesome podcast. Before we wrap up, one of my fun go-to questions is a retrospective, and that's to have an opportunity, go back, have a conversation with your younger self. What would you share?
Gosh, I would tell him to say yes to those opportunities, even when you felt like a work deadline made it impossible. I think about certain trips that friends floated my way and I passed up on it. And I know exactly what those events were that I passed up on and who it would have been with. I cannot remember what was the work product that I delivered.
I think that's really valuable insights. It isn't easy, especially when we're younger and we're committed, devoted individuals to what we're doing. But yes, I agree. There's definitely a big picture as well. And depending on how you rank family, friends, yeah, I mean, it's anyone in your life you want to give a shout out to, or whether personally or professionally, who's had a material impact on you over the years?
And actually, thank you. I'd love to give a shout out to my dear friend, Eringer Helbling. She started this outfit called Damati Ventures, and it's sort of a part-time advisory firm, as well as a yoga practice. And the whole intention behind this firm is to sort of create connectivity within a local community, right? That person to person. And so Eringer, she's a former Army intel officer, also still a reservist, has worked at a lot of great startups, both in the space and artificial intelligence area. And I've just been very intentional about the way that she is building her life today with these different services. And I was just out on the National Mall yesterday, and I try to go every Tuesday morning as they do this thing called Project Sunrise. And it's yoga right in front of the Lincoln Memorial at 06:30. And it's just a no better way to start the day. And so I'm really thankful for her friendship and mentorship. And yeah, love to give her and the firm a shout out.
And how do you pronounce your first name again?
Eringer, Eringer.
Right. Well, great stuff. Shout out to Aringer. On a parallel note, the missus and I picked up pickleball 2 years ago.
Ah, awesome.
Got bitten by the bug, but it was one of the observations that I had is I found it's done an amazing job of helping us meet other people in our community to a degree. Probably a subject for another podcast, maybe not the innovators and investors, but I've witnessed a whole host of polarization over the preceding years, and I found that this connection doing physical activity has gone
Yes.
a long way to kind of diffusing differences, because everyone seems to kind of get along when you're doing exercise or playing a game. So good on
So
her.
true.
David, thank you again. Appreciate your time. Really, a tremendous amount of insights. And congrats again on a really successful career. It sounds like the NVCA had really good reason for recognizing you. And I know our audience appreciates it well.
Thank you so much, Christian. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. And with that, again, for the benefit of our audience, David Rothside, principal at Shield Capital. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, Please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.